His new book is called Off the Record, but when you're calling into the radio, I mean, everything's on the record, right? Legendary Canadian newsman Peter Mansbridge is joining us on the line. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Jeremy. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Well, it's been a few years since we've chatted. I think the last time was for a royal wedding, and you said that'll never last. Am I recalling that correctly?
Well, I was going with the track record of royal weddings of the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. It hasn't been too good.
True. Yeah, absolutely. Now, I have to ask you, though, when you retire from the news business, or at least from the anchor chair, are there times that you watch a story play out now and want to get back behind the desk? I imagine, you know, the stories of, you know, Corona and the Trump years and all these other big stories. Does it make you want to get right in there again or no?
Well, I think there's part of you when you're a journalist that's always chasing fire engines. You know, you can't let them pass even if you've stopped covering them on a regular basis. And, you know, it's the same now. I mean, I don't dwell on it. I don't wake up in the mornings going, oh, man, I wish I still had that job. Because I don't. It was time for a break. I'm doing other things. I'm writing books. I do a podcast. I'm shooting documentaries for the CBC, where I worked all those years. And so, you know, I'm still busy. It's just a very different pace, and I get to set it.
The book gives readers an entire behind-the-scenes look at, you know, your life and then also just even the news business itself. This is probably a difficult question, but what's the one surprising thing people will learn about the business and journalism that they might not have expected? And you can't say that it's you guys wear shorts and sandals behind the desk, because we already know that one. We know that.
Yeah. Listen, there are a lot of those behind-the-scenes moments in the book. It really is kind of the story behind the story. And in most cases, you know, whether you're doing an interview at the White House or whether you're, you know, in Afghanistan covering, you know, one of that conflict, or in Iraq, wherever, there are things happen that you don't tell on the air at the time because they don't seem that important. Then when you're kind of reflecting on your career, you look back and, you know, those moments were pretty important, and they give a sense to the reader of what, you know, daily journalism is really like and can be, you know, challenging, obviously, for the journalist, but it can also be fun. So there's a whole mix of, you know, whether they're funny moments or emotional moments, they all tend to tell you something about the business of journalism, which is, you know, for those of us in it, it's a very exciting profession. It's a profession that gets you, you know, around, in my case, around the world, and certainly around the country, around Canada, you know, for a long period of time. And in my particular case, it was something that I hadn't planned on doing. I didn't grow up saying, man, I want to be a journalist. I just kind of got into it by a fluke. But when I did, I realized, man, this is really the place that I not only want to be, but I should be.
I mean, it has taken you all across the country anyway, just from reporting and then, or from anchoring and then around the world, of course, too. Now, being from Winnipeg, I was intrigued by that chapter. You called the city a disgusting and filthy... I'm kidding, everybody. He does not.
Don't get me into trouble.
Well, I'm going to get letters, too. But, I mean, I know the story, but for others, maybe, why Manitoba and Winnipeg are significant to your career? Would you just touch on that for a second?
Yeah, sure. I never finished high school. I never went to university. I ended up at 19 years old working in northern Manitoba, up on Hudson Bay, in a little community called Churchill. And when I was there, I was working for an airline. I was doing everything from loading bags to selling tickets. And one day, the regular ticket agents, who were kind of swamped at the counter, asked me to announce the flight over the PA system in the little airport. So I did, and the next thing I knew, there was a chap in the airport who turned out to be the manager of the local radio station, who came up to me and said, hey, you know, you've got a good voice. Have you ever thought about radio? And I said, no, I've never thought about radio. It was never on my wish list. And he said, well, I've got an opening. I can't get anybody to fill it. It's the late night shift. And we're talking a small station. It was like 50 watts. You couldn't hear it two blocks from the station. But that's where I started. I started the very next night, and, you know, from one thing led to another over a period of 5 years and a lot of hard work, and that's how I got my start. So when I say it was a fluke, it was a fluke. But it every once in a while you need that kind of a break to get moving and to recognize that you've got an opportunity in front of you, and you better work hard to make it happen.
And I certainly relate to the part where you say you had no idea what you were doing, because all this time later, Peter, I still have no idea what I'm doing, but I'm coasting along nicely, so.
Yeah, that was certainly the case for me. I mean, literally, I had about a 1 hour training session, and the next thing I knew, I was sitting at the board where you control everything as the, kind of the local DJ. Mm-hmm. You pick the music, you run it, you talk in between the records. This was the 60s, so it was a great time for music, but still, it was all self-taught. I wasn't very good at dealing with the music, but I loved talking on air, and so what I was good at was recognizing what was going on around me in terms of news events, and so I started a newscast that didn't have one, and that's how I made my reputation, and I... You know, people heard about me from outside of northern Manitoba, and one thing led to another, and the rest is history.
And that was the 60s. People don't realize that you invented the selfie back in the 70s.
Well, there is actually a selfie of me in China in 76 on the Great Wall of China. I remember taking that picture because I thought I got to get a picture of me on the Great Wall. And so I turned my little, little Canon camera around and took a picture of myself. So, the selfies were around long before cell phones.
But, I mean, it was a gamble when you were doing those. You didn't want to waste all of your film, and you don't get that instant, right? You don't get that instant display if you're actually in frame.
Right.
So
you got to wait a couple of weeks in some cases to find out whether you actually got the shot you were dreaming of.
So here we go, everybody. This is how he prioritized using his film, was, did I get the shot of me or the news event I was covering? There you go, right?
Right.
One of the stories you talked about last time when you were on with us, so I hope you'll share it again, is the awkward moment covering the Royals, because I always get a kick out of news bloopers. Can you share that story? Because it's in the book. It made the book.
Yeah, it did make the book. It was Princess Margaret, the Queen's younger sister. She's passed now, unfortunately, but when she used to travel in the 60s and 70s, even in the 80s, it was a big deal, unlike today, where the kind of minor royals don't get as much airtime as they did in those days. But when Margaret traveled, it was a big deal. She came to Winnipeg, and she was there to open an art gallery. And so we decided we were going to cover her arrival live at the airport. And so they sent me out as this hot young kid from just come down from Churchill and moved to Winnipeg to do the live coverage. So I'm out there waiting for the plane to arrive, and I'd been promised that she'd be the very first person off the plane. And I was at some distance away, but the camera, of course, was in on a close-up shot. So I saw this woman appear at the top of the steps, and I said, there she is, Princess Margaret, what a historic day for Winnipeg, blah, blah, blah. And I suddenly hear in my ear said, that's not Princess Margaret. And I realized, no, it's not Princess Margaret. She had kind of wings on the lapel of her jacket. It was the flight attendant, or what we called in those days the stewardess. So that was a bit of a blunder, and a lot of the people who thought I was moving too fast in the system took some solace in that to say, you know, you got to hold this kid back. He doesn't know what he's doing.
Hey, I had a red carpet moment where the winner of a reality show was standing there with his wife, and I referred to her as his mom. So
that's not a good sign.
No, it was not. It was not good.
That would not have gone over well.
One question that I'm always asked, though, as an entertainment reporter, is, you know, who was the best interview, and then who was the worst interview? And I always ask for clarity, because a good interview could mean that the person answered the questions and was entertaining, or it could be good because it was just so awkward and it went viral. How do you answer that question of your best and worst interview? And who was it?
Well, you know, you've done a lot of interviews. I've probably done 20,000, so it's hard to kind of narrow it down to, you know, was it Obama? Was it Mandela? Was it you know, Pierre Trudeau, Justin Trudeau, was it the Dalai Lama or the Aga Khan, or, you know, sports celebrities, entertainment celebrities. There's been so many of them. I know the worst was, it was Margaret Thatcher. I'd interviewed her a few times, but in the last time I interviewed her in the 90s after she'd left office, she was selling a book. And it was just a disastrous interview. I was trying to challenge her on parts of the book. She kept saying, "You never read the book." So it was like the interview sort of went from bad to worse. That one didn't go very well. But you know, there are lots of good interviews. I'll be honest. I tend to, you know, the big celebrity names, it's great to interview them. And it feels good to have added those to your kind of roster of people you've talked to. But quite frankly, they've all been interviewed 100 times before. So trying to get them to say something different can often be a challenge. But the people who really do deliver in an interview are basically the ordinary people who have some extraordinary story to tell. You know you're not getting spin. You know you're hearing the real deal. You're hearing it as it happened. And, you know, whether I was interviewing boat people coming out of Vietnam in the late 1970s or people who'd escaped the tsunami in Sri Lanka and you know, in 2004, 2005, or you know, people coming through the wall in Berlin the weekend it came down in 1989. All those moments are, you know, seared in my mind as, you know, special interviews with very special people, and ones I'll never forget.
One special person you write about, Walter Cronkite, obviously, you know, he passed many years ago, but Let's play along with this one. Somehow you two can talk today, and the discussion is world events and the news. What's your opening line to Walter Cronkite?
I probably want to know how he would handle dealing with politicians who lie. Because that has become such a thing today. I mean, we tend to talk about Trump all the time, but he's not alone. There are many political figures, both in our case south of the border in the U.S., but also in our jurisdiction in Canada. And Cronkite had a way of dealing with, you know, with his interview subjects, which cut to the chase and didn't let them get away with anything. And I would love to being able to have that kind of a conversation with him, because the times are so different. You know, politicians have always shaded the truth to some degree, but out and out lying is quite another thing. And, you know, we're living in an era where it's awfully difficult to believe what you're hearing, and because the lie has become an acceptable art form.
Well, I mean, if I can quote, you know, a legendary icon, as the old fart in the room, my tendency is to argue for a return to the basics. Focus on facts, not bullshit. Admit mistakes. Understand responsibility. Serve the people, not the elite. But that just may not cut it anymore. Too much has changed. So this book is dedicated to your grandkids. How would you compare the news business back then to now? Because they obviously haven't seen exactly what it was like decades ago.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to talk about, you know, the back then as the golden era of news. There was nothing golden about it. I mean, we had lots of problems. Today has the opportunity to be light years ahead of any time in the history of the planet, really, because of the technology that we have available to us. You know, we can shoot anything and anywhere at any time. There are no deadlines anymore. The deadline is airtime. So those are all the good things. The bad things are, you know, dealing with information. There's so much bad information, misinformation, disinformation out there. And I worry and I'm concerned about the ability of today's journalism in dealing with that. Listen, there's some great news organizations, but there are so many different news organizations now that some of them really don't carry their responsibility in a fashion that would encourage people to believe what they're hearing or seeing or reading. And that's the big challenge for journalism today, is to be believable. I mean, when people come up to you and say, believe what you're saying. We should recognize that we got a problem with that. So when my grandkids are watching the news today, or reading the news, they tend much more to go to social media for their news, and that can be really challenging. There's a lot of garbage on social media, and trying to fit what's good and what's bad and make the and understand the differences is a big challenge for readers. But for journalists, they got to be more transparent about what they do and how they do it, because people are having trouble believing what they're seeing, reading, and hearing.
Absolutely. You know, I have to wrap this up. We're almost out of time. But, you know, back in the day when I started in newspapers, the saying was, if it bleeds, it leads. You've heard that one.
Yeah. Yeah, that was never really true, for starters. Listen, if we wanted to lead with whatever bleeds, you'd have an hour program every night with just ugly stories.
Gore, yeah.
Because there's lots of that stuff available all the time, you know, whether it's car accidents or fires or wars or drownings or what have you. There's lots of material that's kind of out there. But responsible news organizations, you know, make calls every day about what's actually responsible in terms of, you know, telling stories and how much of that kind of stuff you actually need to put on. Listen, we live in a world where accidents happen, and you know, and ugly things are available, but doesn't mean you have to show them all the time. So I've never been a big believer in the if it bleeds, it bleeds. That was just a different way of criticizing the news media of that era. Right now, the challenge isn't that. The challenge is trusting what you're seeing and hearing and reading. Is it real? Is it true? And how do you know it's true? And have they convinced you that what they're dealing in a responsible and accurate fashion?
I've kept you 10 minutes longer than I should, but that brings up the whole other question of how do people know what to trust, where to trust, who to trust? I mean, what would your advice be?
Well, you've got to make that determination yourself by, you know, deciding whether you trust certain news organizations or certain news journalists, and you'll make that determination based on how transparent they are in telling you the stories they're telling you. You know, how believable is their information? Do you know where it came from? Are you seeing what they're saying? And, you know, do you understand the decisions they're making in getting to the point of reporting? Why are certain stories on the air, certain stories aren't on the air? You know, why do some sources get anonymity and other sources not get anonymity? You know, you can see how a news organization operates and then make your decisions about who you trust and who you don't trust. So you have a responsibility as a news consumer to make judgments. You're not just looking for who's telling you what you want to hear. You're looking for who's telling you what you can believe is true.
Absolutely. Peter, it's flashing on my screen, wrap up like it's the Oscars, so I'm going to have to let you go. The book is called, it's called Off the Record, The Canadian News Icon. Peter Mansbridge is the author. Thanks so much for the chat. Love the book, and people should definitely check it out. Thank you so much for your time, Peter.
Jeremy, it's always good to talk to you. You take care.
Thanks, you too.